are listening to Free City Radio. It is Wednesday, the 6th of April, and I'm your host in Montreal, Stefan Christophe. This is the 104th edition of the program. Thank you so much for being with us. Today, I'm going to be speaking with Jack Z. Bracic, who wrote the book On Microfascism, Gender, War, and Death. This is a book published by Common Notions, commonnotions.org, an excellent activist publishing house. This book explores the ways that contemporary fascism is mobilized in micro moments. A lot of people might be familiar with the term microaggressions. The ideas in this book are important to think about how those micro moments build into a broader power of extremist right-wing movements, but also how do we mobilize in the micro to confront these small moments, but also the broader dangerous manifestations of systemic violence in regards to race, gender, and class. These are essential issues at this moment and encourages us to look to the long term and the systemic in terms of mobilizing in this moment of urgency. I think this book is important, and it was great to speak with Jack today. Here is my conversation.
Thanks, Stefan. It's a pleasure to be here. And I will say I'm actually based in Philadelphia right now. I moved out of New York some years ago, but I teach in New Jersey, so at Rutgers. So yeah, but so the tri-state area here, but I'm coming to you directly from South Philadelphia. Thanks. And so, yeah, so I, you know, and I'm happy to be part of Common Notions as well, an excellent press that has been really working, I think, recently on this idea of how do we think through and about fascism in and anti-fascism in both grounded ways, but also innovative ways. And I hope my book is contributing to that. So let me just say a little bit about how the book came about. In around 2017, I was asked by Peter Werby at Fifth Estate magazine, a longstanding, well-known anarchist magazine, to write a piece about things that were going on in the moment around the emergence and election of Trump and some of his followers. So what I did was I was looking at some of the kind of alt-right street protests that were happening at the time, and this was right before Charlottesville, and you know, trying to make sense of this world in which people seem to be dressing up and doing cosplay and kind of humorous, ironic, trolling versions of street protests that were still kind of tied to authoritarian models of thinking and ways of being. So how do we, you know, it was a moment we're trying to think through, like, what are these kind of trolling actions doing politically? And of course, soon after I wrote it, Charlottesville happened. And so we saw the deadly results of some of those kinds of protests. So that got me thinking about culture and about ways of identifying fascism before we often see it in its familiar forms, right? So the book is kind of animated by this question of, as anti-fascists, how do we identify the enemy? And it's a question that's been longstanding in some ways. In mid-80s, Umberto Eco, in a piece called Ur-Fascism, 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 said, people keep talking about, like, well, we can't have them return, right? They can't return. And so he asked the question, but who are they, right? When they're not in the same kinds of formations, ideologies, styles, uniforms, all the aesthetics that we're used to, right? So how do we begin to identify fascism before it kind of appears in familiar ways, and also before it becomes a kind of organized either political party or even social movement, much less a state formation? So these things were kind of animating the question of this book for me then to look at ways of thinking about the emergence of recent fascism and around this idea that was initially kind of introduced by Felix Guattari, sometimes in conversation with Gilles Deleuze, sometimes not on his own, of microfascism. So I'll pause there to just say that, you know, one of the things that that I found in writing the book is that I had to learn a little bit more about fascism studies, and I realized like there's so much out there and there's so little consensus on what fascism is that it was hard to kind of make a definitive sort of claim on it because of the way that the debate goes. But I can certainly talk a little bit about how the book begins to work through both I thinking about fascism and specifically this idea of microfascism as well. So
Well, thank you so much. One point in the many threads that you were sharing in your first comments is to think about also addressing fascism and, as you talked about, the manifesting of fascism in micro ways or microfascism. Now, I just would like to maybe draw a little bit about what you mentioned in the fact that there is not a consensus on the definition of fascism, and that's going back broadly to the era of fascism in Europe, starting between the First and Second World Wars, even. But that, of course, expands to many examples globally. And I bring this up just to think about how we are addressing manifestations of fascism today. You're obviously connected to activist movements and anti-fascist movements as a writer. And so I say this just to bring up, I think, an issue that a lot of activists face, which is how do we mobilize effectively, in the face of what seems to be an overwhelming force? And you mentioned cosplay and you mentioned performance. And a lot of people, I think, would look to the manifestations of contemporary neo-fascism or contemporary fascism, populist right-wing movements at the beginning, especially on the more liberal side of activism, as almost a joke. But in fact, that's not the case. And so, given that it's a real situation, I would be interested if you had any thoughts to share about the importance of micro action and micro mobilization and sort of this, the small level organizing, which, clearly has an impact, but it's hard to judge when mainstream media is feeding us grand narratives about an emerging force without actually dis sort of breaking down the sort of structural issues at play.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yeah, and that animates a lot of what I was trying to get at is this sort of like the layer of everyday life and ordinariness in which something like fascism begins to percolate before we even can identify it in its again recognizable ways. And I think I would say also that my book comes out at a moment. Now it's like there was a lot of really great work at the beginning of the rise of the alt-right and of Trump that was trying to make sense of this through questions around humor and trolling and irony and the ways that online versions of this were coming offline and so that formation. So I think there was an important moment of documenting that, and I think now there are a couple of or a few works out now. Eva Meshefsky's feminist anti-fascism, Lori Penny's new book on the sexual revolution about feminism being anti-fascist, and to sort of say like, okay, well, what is also sort of persistent or outlasting these even the what we saw in early days is alt-right, which itself is kind of scattered. It doesn't really exist in that same way anymore. Post-Trump in that kind of classic moment, at least in the States, right? So this is where something like I think the micro becomes an important zone of analysis, and I'll get to the organization part as well. I think what one of the ways that that the micro, the way I think about the micro is not just that it's small, it's more about its pervasiveness and everydayness, right? So if you think about less about like microbes and more about the microbiome, right? A kind of environment or a kind of ecology, something that surrounds us that isn't always easily perceptible or visible, but something that we that actually shapes us, right? So that's one of the ways I think the micro was important here. Also that it, at least in the sense that was developed in a scattered form by Deleuze and Guattari, it also involves desire and subjectivity. It means recognizing that, as they have said, as others have said, like it's the fascist in us all, right? Even though I wouldn't always say that, you know, I wouldn't universalize it to that degree, but there is a sense that where we need to, what we need to investigate are these forms of relationships, of everyday interactions that begin to kind of compose a social body from which then more organized forms of recognizable fascism emerges. So that's where this idea of the structure that even these micro actions they're not like individualized. I mean, they can be sort of brought into an individual, but these are already legacies of things like settler colonialism. And for me, specifically in this book, it's about tracing the kind of gendered dimension of this over time, and asking, well, what if we started with gender to understand fascism rather than race or colonialism or anti-Semitism, which of course are, you know, crucial and components to this specifically as a form of genocide. But I also wanted to say, and I'm not, you know, other people have already done a lot of that work, right? To look at, you know, even during the interwar period in the 20th century, there were thinking of people like George Padmore, people like M.A. Cesare, right? To think about how these were colonial techniques that were being brought back to Europe, right? So that work, I think, is so important and needs to be read and understood before we fixate on the particular period and particular state formations of it. So once we start expanding that out, you know, one of the things I wanted to also then add, and I'm not necessarily the first, but it's a way of saying, in this moment, what would it mean to give gender the kind of central place to think about the forms of subjectivity that also begin, that form themselves through eliminating others. That was sort of one of the key sort of you know, kind of moves in the book, is to talk about formations of modern and even pre-modern masculine subjectivity that forms itself and renews itself by the exclusion and reduction of others, specifically women. So in that case, if we do that, then we begin to see micro interactions that would be at the level, for one thing, of like, you know, a more common word, like microaggressions, for instance. Like microaggressions themselves are not just about the small things that people do, right? I mean, the smallness is already a kind of microcosm or a way of resonating with these longer standing structures that also systematically reduce, eliminate others, with capital O. So if we think about that as a form of microaggressions, we can pay attention to that as places where something like fascism begins to form itself. And in this case, you know, I could also just say, because I also like citing people, even though, you know, I'm an academic, so I like citing people, but I also want to say, like, if you want to read further, don't just read my book. There are people who have done that kind of work. So David Neuwirth's book, The Eliminationists, speaks to like the ways that anti-Semitic jokes and insults, right, were so crucial to the rise of Nazi Germany, right? So to begin to look at those kind of places. So that's the kind of analytic zone. And then, so organizing would be to understand not just our individual kind of desires, the way we have romantic relationships or produce collectives together, and what kind of things are sort of prioritized over others. I think those are quite important things, obviously. It's also to think about how those seemingly, you know, ordinary moments are resonating with something larger. And so to me, one of the ways I sort of, you know, the last chapter in the book, which is beginning to look at types of micro anti-fascism, right, is what the book wants to sort of get to. By first we identify what this zone is, but then let's go into who might be already making these connections. And I find the kind of global anti-feminicide work and the global feminist and transnational feminist networks to be a crucial site for understanding this, because there's some of the biggest street mobilizations over the past few years that have happened around that. But at the same time, these are about talking about state formations and the kind of systematic killing of women for being women. But at the same time, they're tying that to also everyday interactions, domestic violence, right? The ways that interpersonal relations are always connected to also state and police formations, as well as finance capital at times to an extractive policy. So but I think that would be one place to look for how this is being articulated as a kind of mobilization. There are others as well, but I think that's certainly one, given our time, that I would want to just point to.
Thank you so much for sharing those reflections. I think that, you know, one interesting thread that would be good to pick up on for this conversation could be around the idea that social movement mobilization against fascism on a broader collective level that manifests through a sort of immeasurable amount of mobilization on a micro level. We see sort of moments of mass mobilization, but I think often lost in those narratives of how the stories of these mobilizations against fascism are told are the micro moments of mobilization. And beyond that, I would be interested in hearing your thoughts about this idea of the importance of political reference points in mobilizations against fascism, because I think that liberal narratives often remove the social, political, personal power that these mobilization spaces create as references in the micro. So when people are thinking about how to mobilize against fascism, those moments become so important. But beyond that, I think in terms of creating like a cultural resistance, we do see people gravitating towards ideas that are out there, right? And unfortunately, in this era, I think on a youth level, we do see, especially online, the influence of extreme right-wing, nationalist, racist ideas that were given a pass from a lot of major social media corporations that aren't invested in thinking structurally about these issues. And that has resulted in a lot of physical violence and a lot of danger and a lot of manifesting of these longer legacies of colonialist violence and gender-based violence and structural racism. So I would ask you, in that context, can you talk about the importance of holding on to these reference points and to think about how they manifest in possibility on the micro level and create alternative frameworks and points of how people are interacting with the ideas and also possibilities for mobilization on a micro level?
Wow, yeah, that's really profound, in the sense that it also gets to like how we move forward, both analytically and practically through praxis, as well as thinking. And I think this is what I was trying to work mostly with, the analytic part, to sort of like keep those political reference points. But I'll pick up on one, the first one thing, I'll say this first. I think we're in a moment right now of simultaneously a kind of urgency that people want to do things to stop the reformation, the emergence, the kind of reorganization of fascism. There's an urgency to it. There's also a moment of intense reflection on tactics, on how we do this, on how we think through this. And so, you know, this is kind of what I've been seeing is both of those happening, and with different kinds of sort of moments. Because, right, again, there was an easy way to kind of mobilize against, in the Eastern States, against Trump, and against Trumpists and MAGAists, because it was easily identifiable. But then without that, it's like, okay, well, what is the what are the reference points that then we can say, like, well, this is what we're trying to also draw from and identify at the same time as problematic. So there's the reflection part, but I wanted to get to the thing about the kind of the marginalization or erasure of the kind of ordinary, the micro, the everyday, when it came to, I would say, yeah, centrist or liberal kinds of approaches to anti-fascism, which tended to identify it along party lines or along, again, very visible versions of this, to the extent that, yeah, it ignored a lot of these older or more structural political reference points. So when people start identifying fascism as just kind of anti-liberal democracy, it's like, it's quite, you know, it obviously ignores the way that liberal democracy itself functions and operates on a series of structural inequalities around race, around class, and I would add around gender, that that themselves were the places where the fascism festers primarily, not about, you know, a kind of political formation that is against equality or something like that. But, you know, that there's it has that, but the inequalities that actually inform liberal democracy are the things that also get reactivated by reactionaries. So in that case, then even the kind of idea of the public-private split, in which case centrist and liberal democracy would operate on this distinction, and then say, well, the jokes, that part of culture, I mean, that's the private realm, and that's, you know, that might be important, but it's like what we're dealing with is the public sphere, and so when fascists show up there, then we figure out how to deal with them, but the other parts are you know, sort of get taken as given. That is, you know, this is the realm of freedom of speech. If you know, when culture, when the trolls are making these sort of threats against women, you know, it's like, well, we can't really do anything about that, because what we're really worried about is preserving the center. So I would say, to clarify that a little more, I think we're at a moment right now where we're in the middle of two wars, what I call two wars of restoration. On the one hand is the more kind of obvious reactionary fascist one that wants to restore moments of either, you know, nationalism in the U.S., the founding of the U.S., which is also a settler colonial moment, which is also a restoration of certain kind of patriarchal relations and in the disguise of traditionalism. Okay, that's an obvious one. The other one, though, is there's something that's more tied, I would say, with centrism and the liberal democratic state, which is, let's restore, at least in the U.S., America, to the moment of where we were civil, where there was a consensus around politics, and kind of bring back the antagonisms against extremism, right? And it's anti-extremist, which ends up being, turns out, both right and left for centrists. Now, the reason I bring that up is I think that war of restoration is also trying to now define fascism and what it means to be anti-fascist. So the centrists are also now saying, like, they're interested in anti-fascism and they want to stop it, but in doing so, they're defining it in a very particular way. And so it's what we, you know, what I find myself doing, and I adhere more to, you know, what Matthew Lyons and other people have called the three-way fight, right? You have to fight the rise of reactionary fascists, but at the same time also resist the state that wants to become the definer and the actor through either carceral techniques or other sorts of modes of thinking and being that's going to stop that, right?
I thank you so much for highlighting that. It seems like in a lot of ways that the liberal, you know, I mean, in Canada, it would be the Liberal Party, is trying to own what it means to be anti-fascist, and through that disempower social movements.
Exactly. So I think that needs to be sort of like foregrounded for those of us who don't want, you know, parties or states to define those problems and those solutions, because as we know, those solutions will often take us up in that net as well.
Yeah, and I mean, that's so important, because do our struggles just reinforce the existing historical power relations that got us here in the first place? So in terms of like Liberal Party legacies in Canada, it would be like, do we want to reinforce the structures of settler colonialism that has led to the structural inequalities and systemic racism and genocidal policies against Indigenous people that are foundational to the Canadian state? And I think that, you know, a lot of the points you brought up, Jack, around thinking critically through this are not easy. And I think, you know, it's really interesting, because I think there could be a tendency, because of the urgency of the situation, to think in shorthand, right? And I've always thought about the term shortcuts, right? And then, but on a longer arc, I think it's so critical, a lot of what you're saying, because without thinking through these layers, then we end up with shortcuts. And we know what shortcuts have brought us, which is the failure of the Liberal Democratic Center to hold against extremism, right? And, you know, and I think that explains a lot of issues, not all the issues.
Absolutely. I mean, sometimes you're right. The long cut is needed, even in the moment of urgency and the immediacy of stopping, right? And so, I mean, how do we have hold both of those simultaneously? And I think that's, I mean, it's not the first time. I think people who consider themselves either on the left or anti-authoritarian or have had to address that. But it's but I think we have a peculiar situation insofar as the extent to which both of those things are intensified right now, both the urgency and the need for the long cut.
So thanks so much for taking the time to speak today, Jack.
I appreciate it, Stefan.
That was a conversation with Jack Zed Bracic, who wrote the book on microfascism, Gender, War, and Death. You can find out more about that at commonnotions.org. This has been the 104th edition of Free City Radio. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph, in Montreal. We share a new episode every week, and we broadcast on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal, Wednesdays at 11, CJLO 1690 AM in Montreal, Tuesdays at 1, and are now broadcasting on Wednesday mornings on CKUW in Winnipeg, Treaty 1 territory of the Métis people. Thank you so much for being with us. I'll go out with an excerpt of a recent duet that I released with cellist Lori Goldston. I'm playing organ. This is called Birds in Trio. Thanks again to Jack, and also shout out to Malav of Common Notions, who helped set up this interview. Take care, everybody, and I'll speak to you next week.
following is a previously broadcast program.
With a voice like that, you know you gotta go, baby. This is the XX Files on CKUT 90.3 FM on April 29th. Last day of April, last day to jam those taxes in on the e-file plane here in Canada. We had a little extra time, but it's over now. File your taxes. And 29 April, it's warm and, yeah, it's kind of chilly, I'm lying, sorry. It's sunny. It hasn't been warm since Monday when it was super hot. And I don't know, it's supposed to rain tonight, tomorrow, get colder, then get nicer. It's back to the normal springtime thing, folks. You have a little summer taste, but it's not really June or July yet. But Star Trek Zero, it's coming out. Uhuru, uhuru, who is she? It's almost May, and the Biennale de Montréal is starting off, so we've got lots of spring cleaning, you know? It's the end of the deal of the April. We're done with the cold. Nobody will wear a hat today, even though we should be. So it's just spring cleaning, folks. It's time to figure out what's going on. HIAP production residencies are up online. HIAP. Do you know what that is? That's the Helsinki International Artist in Residence Program. Helsinki in the summer. It's the place to be on the North Sea, baby. And this is a great artist residency because of the length, the amount, what you do. It's all negotiable. Talk to them. You don't have to get in.